This is Company Cars, the podcast that tries to make sense of the car business. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Company Cars. On this episode, we're going to change things up a little bit and switch from talking about the industry to getting tactical and talking about consumers and what we should do as consumers in response to industry trends. So I hope you enjoyed our last episode about how corporate average fuel economy standards work and how they affect the cars that automakers choose to sell and produce in the United States. So in this episode, we'll revisit a topic from a previous episode and something that's been on everybody's mind, and that is the supply shortage of new cars and how this supply shortage of new cars is wreaking havoc on the car market, both the new car market and the used car market. If you'll recall from our episode 6 months ago, I largely advised waiting on your new car purchase if you could, but I didn't really address what you should do if you find yourself unable to wait any longer. Also at the time, we didn't know as much as we know today about the extent of the production and supply chain disruptions that automakers face. So we'll discuss how to navigate the crazy, insane car market right now in the unfortunate event that you do need to buy a new car. On this episode, we'll also talk about my latest experience with rental car roulette and check in on how Hertz is doing as it exits bankruptcy and prepares for a new fleet of Teslas. How bad is the car market doing right now? And it's doing pretty bad. So the chip shortage that many in the industry thought would ease into the fourth quarter of this year as chip production ramped up and slowly continue easing into 2022, now looks like it'll impact a large chunk of 2022 production, with things not really resembling anywhere close to normal until late 2022 or early 2023 in some cases. And what's interesting is now the issues that automakers face are expanding beyond semiconductor chips and various computer modules that go into cars, with broader supply chain disruptions beginning to affect other parts like the availability of certain fabrics, materials, supplier modules, features that have resulted in automakers having to make adjustments to the feature content in cars as the year rolls on. So many automakers are starting to make mid-year adjustments to feature content in cars and removing certain features where availability of those parts are becoming particularly constrained. So two really good examples of this, and the first is General Motors is removing Super Cruise, its flagship advanced driver assistance technology, from the options list for the Cadillac Escalade, its high-end luxury SUV. And the reason GM is doing this is they see that they have a severe shortage of these modules from their suppliers, and they're trying to prioritize the cars that get Super Cruise as optional equipment. Specifically, General Motors is trying to prioritize the availability of these Super Cruise modules for its forthcoming electric cars, the GMC Hummer and the Cadillac Lyriq. Separately, BMW has quietly dropped wireless charging from certain cars in its lineup because of the availability of the wireless charging pads to install in cars. So I believe BMW has dropped wireless charging from X5, X3, and maybe the 3 Series. I'm not completely certain on the 3 Series, but I know it's gone from X3 and X5, I think. So what's happening is if you go to an automaker's website, you'll oftentimes see a warning now that says that they are facing severe supply chain disruptions and to check with your local dealer on the availability of certain features and parts. Because this is such a fluid situation and things are changing so rapidly that automakers are having to make feature decisions on the fly and decide whether to hold a car and wait for the part to show up or to go ahead and ship the car without the feature and issue a small price credit to the end buyer. But this episode isn't about the automakers. This episode is about us as car shoppers and consumers and what we should do. So what to do if you need to buy a new car right now? And that lies the problem, because even though supply chain issues are disrupting production, demand is extremely strong because a lot of buyers have put off their purchases over the past 18 months and can't really wait any longer or don't want to wait any longer, and thus they're starting to brave the market. In addition, we have purchases and events that result from people who can't wait. So for example, when somebody totals a car, or when somebody turns 16 and needs a car, or somebody moves to a new city and needs a car, some buyers just can't actually wait right now. And so even though there's a lot of us sitting on the sidelines as buyers, it's gotten really rough that Even though a lot of people have chosen to wait out and sit out the market, there's still far more demand than supply in terms of new cars. So what does this mean for us as buyers? And if you had talked to me prior to the pandemic, you probably heard a very familiar story of the best way to shop for a new car. And that is, you test drive 3 or 4 different cars, then you choose a car that you liked the most out of the bunch, and then you emailed a bunch of dealers and asked them for their out-the-door price, inclusive of all taxes and fees. And then you chose the most compelling offer to you, which was not always necessarily the lowest price, but maybe some mix of convenience, price, and service. But the best approach has changed, because now the dealerships have most of the negotiating leverage, and dealerships are receiving fewer and fewer cars, so they need to try to make up more and more profit on each car to keep the lights on for themselves. So in this market, the goalposts have changed, and I think the goalpost now is to just try to keep things as close to MSRP as possible. So dealers are taking advantage of this supply and demand mismatch, and many dealers are charging well above MSRP, even for cars that are typically pretty common and easy to find, like Toyota Corollas or Honda Accords. And so dealers are starting to charge a lot more for these, and so you hear stories of Kia Fortes going for $3,000 above MSRP, or Mercedes C-Classes going for $5,000 or $7,000 above MSRP, even though the C-Class is at the end of its life cycle and would usually otherwise have pretty steep discounts on them as we approach the end of its product cycle. However, even though there's many dealers who are trying to charge above MSRP on consumers' purchases, there are still many dealers that will try to sell you a car at MSRP or sometimes even lower. And the issue is finding a dealer that's willing to sell a car at MSRP or maybe even a little bit below MSRP. And these dealers usually require a bit of patience to work with because a lot of people have figured out that these dealers have the best deals, and oftentimes these dealers have sold pretty much a large chunk of their incoming allocation. And so it becomes a function of being patient and waiting in line to get your new car. And so the tricky part is finding these dealers, because oftentimes many dealers don't want to tell you upfront that they're going to be a dealer that wants to charge you $5,000 or $7,000 or $10,000 above MSRP. So the basics of the strategy are still pretty similar in the sense that if you're buying a brand new car, you should reach out to a large number of dealers and to try to get a feel for what their total out-the-door price would be, including all taxes and fees. So in other words, what is the size of the check that you would need to bring to take the car home at whatever day the car comes in, whether that's today or in 2 weeks or in 3 weeks or in a month. And so a lot of dealers will get really squirrely with this number, and so the trick becomes finding somebody who's willing to work with you upfront and give you all the information that you need to make an informed decision. So the way a dealer behaves in their interactions with you probably will also say something about what they're doing. And many dealers are approaching the additional markup piece differently. So some dealers are straight adding $3,000 or $5,000 to every MSRP and not including any other stuff with it, while other dealers are trying to at least try and justify some of the $3,000, $5,000, $7,000 they're adding to MSRP by giving you things that are low cost for them to add but may have a high retail price. So things like tinted windows, ceramic coating, paint protection, fabric protection, etc., etc. So dealers are all creative and different in how they're working with this supply shortage to try to make the best of it for themselves. And so it just becomes trying to find a dealer that's either willing to sell at MSRP or has the smallest markup over MSRP possible. The other change that's happened as we've moved into this supply-constrained world is that it's pretty unlikely you'll be able to walk into a dealership, write a check, and drive off in a car that day, unless it's a dealer that has marked up their car sufficiently so that they always have a couple cars lying around that they're willing to sell at a steep markup. And so this means that buying a new car, to the extent that you can predict when you'll need a new car, becomes more important because you're likely going to be purchasing a car out of that particular dealer's future deliveries and future shipments from the automaker. So usually dealers are told about a month or 2 months or 3 months in advance or longer, depending on the automaker, what products are and what cars are in their pipeline and what cars will be allocated to them based on the manufacturer's allocation schedules and the manufacturer's production schedules. So what a lot of dealers are practicing right now is selling the pipeline, as the industry parlance term is called. And what they're doing is, let's say a customer comes into a dealership and says, I'm interested in a Honda Accord. Well, the dealer has no Honda Accords on the lot, but they can look in their computer and see that of the 10 Accords that they have coming in, 7 have already been spoken for, and so they can sell you one of the 3 remaining Accords in their allocation for a particular time period. And the thing is to remember is that these allocation windows can change, especially if the car hasn't been produced yet. So if the car's been produced, then it's just waiting to be shipped to the dealer, and so you're just waiting for a slot on a car carrier, which is non-trivial in terms of the variance in how long that wait might be, but it's definitely less variance than if you're buying a car or an allocation that hasn't even been manufactured yet. So make sure to delineate between the two and that you fully understand the production status of the car that you're committing to, whether that is a car that is in the allocation for that dealer, so it's a car they're supposed to get but hasn't been produced, or whether it's a car they're supposed to get and has already been produced but is just sitting around waiting for a car carrier or a particular part. And this is something that only the dealer that you're working with can tell you, because it's a computer system between the dealership and the manufacturer that shows this data. And so what's interesting now is this creates kind of a new set of issues to think about that didn't really exist under the old pick a car off the lot and drive off with it right away model. So now one thing to think about is, when you put down a deposit on the car, are you locking in the price of the car? So are you committing to a transaction price with the dealer? And so to the extent that you can fully understand what the price that you'll pay will be, the better off you'll be, because what's happening is some dealers are waiting until the car comes in and then trying to spring a markup on the final buyer at the last minute. So let's say you put in an order 6 months ago for a particular car and you've waited very patiently for 6 months. And what's happened in that 6 months is the market has gotten tighter. Some dealers are saying, okay, we will honor the agreement that we made 6 months ago. This is your car at MSRP or whatever number that you've agreed to. Done. But some dealers, what they're trying to do is say, oh, well, the market has changed and we could actually yank the car from you and sell it to somebody else for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 and dollars over whatever your agreed upon price is. And we're just going to push your order off until later. So to the extent that you can agree upon a price up front, the better off you'll be. And of course, there's still always some risk that this could happen to you. And this is where working with a high quality dealer that you find pleasant to work with becomes even more important. So it's not always just about finding the person who will quote you the lowest price up front, but it's about finding the person who is the most professional about keeping you informed about the order and standing by whatever deal you've agreed upon for that particular order. And now it's time for a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors and we'll share some information about how to submit a listener question. This episode of Company Cars is sponsored by Document Fees, the fees that you forget exist until you go to complete the purchase of your new car. Document Fees. Check in with your local dealer today to see what their document fees are. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, write us an email at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. So this all sounds like a little bit of a hassle, especially compared to the old method of having plenty of cars lying around and you go to the dealer and you pick out what you want and then you write a check, or you email a bunch of dealers and you get the lowest price and then you go to that store and pick up the car right away. And it's definitely a different way of buying a car than it used to be, that's for sure. But this new approach has a couple of advantages to it. So some automakers, what they're trying to do is they're encouraging customers to submit custom orders. So there are several automakers out there who will take custom orders. So this includes Ford, GM, Chrysler, etc. And the nice part about a custom order versus kind of purchasing whatever's on the lot is you can order it with whatever combination of options that the dealer is willing to sell you or the manufacturer is willing to accept for an order. And so I think Ford in particular is trying to encourage this so you can get exactly the feature set that you want. Whereas 3 years ago, maybe you got 90% of what you want, or you had to take 130% of what you wanted. And now if you put in a sold order, then that gives the automaker a sign that, hey, somebody is committed to this car, they want this car, and Ford and GM and Chrysler will actually prioritize production of a sold customer order versus a car that's just going into a dealer's allocation to be sold on the lot. So that's one silver lining, I suppose, to the current supply constraints. The unfortunate part here is some automakers don't really accept custom orders. So Honda, Nissan, Toyota, Hyundai, and Kia don't really accept custom orders in the traditional sense. So let's take Toyota as an example. You can say, I want this particular configuration Corolla, and then you can go to your dealer and say, I want this Corolla. And the best they can do is they can tell Toyota, hey, we have somebody interested in this allocation. But Toyota is not going to go and custom build it for you. Toyota is going to build whatever combinations they've decided to build. It's just that when Toyota goes to allocate those, they will allocate cars that match dealers' requests first to those dealers. So that dealer kind of moves to the front of the line if they have a firm request from you, the customer, that you want a particular combination Toyota Corolla, for example. And the other thing that that dealer can do is they can trade with another dealer's allocation. Let's say dealer B has a Corolla that is exactly what you want, but you have already started working with dealer A. Dealer A can trade a car from their existing allocation for that Corolla that exactly matches your allocation. The challenge is, dealer B, if they know a customer out there actually wants this car, they are not going to trade it to dealer A because they want you, the person buying that Corolla, to come to them to buy the car. So dealer trades are really tricky right now, and a lot of dealers are not working really well with each other to trade, and so it may take some hunting and some searching in a broad geographic area if you're buying a Toyota, Honda, Nissan, or Kia, and you're looking for a very specific configuration car, you may need to do a national search or search more broadly than what you might have searched 2 years ago to find the exact combination car that you want. And so this is definitely a new world with new challenges, but the principles, I think, are still very clear. You want to try to establish your total out-the-door price, including all taxes and fees, as early in the process as possible. You want to compare prices across dealers, if you're talking to multiple dealers, based on the final number, inclusive of all add-ons that a dealer might want to add, because one dealer may have more add-ons in one category and less add-ons in another category, but you don't really care. What you care about is that net bottom line number. And so, you want to find and compare based on that number, but the new variable is you also want to prioritize a dealer who is professional and who is good at keeping you updated and who won't try to sell the car from underneath you. And so that's pretty hard to do, but it's always nice to check kind of the Google reviews for that particular dealer and see what other people are saying. You can also check some owner forums for specific cars. So if you're buying a car with a big enthusiast following. So for example, a Ford Bronco right now. There are dealers out there on the owners forums who are selling Broncos at MSRP or below MSRP, especially if you have a custom order. I mean, these dealers, you may have to wait a long time for your Bronco to come in because they have accepted a lot of Bronco orders, but these dealers know how to work with people who are very interested in the car, and they seem to be fan favorites of the owner's community, and so they're very good at doing a large number of remote custom order cars. Another really good example is if you're interested in a Chrysler product, the owner's forums have whispers about several dealers scattered across the country that are taking orders for Chrysler products below MSRP. And so the catch is, you have to arrange for delivery, but they make it all very clear, and people have had good experience with them. So to the extent that you can find a dealership like that for the particular product you're looking for, the better off you may be. And so there are dealers out there that are trying to experiment with a new business model of selling cars in this constrained economy. And so depending on what you're looking for, working with one of these dealers kind of on a national scale might still be cheaper than walking into your local dealer and signing with them. And so especially these dealers that are very experienced at doing a lot of out-of-state purchases and a lot of out-of-state orders, if you know exactly what you want, then this might be a very efficient process for both you and for the dealer. And so one other thing to think about is if you're thinking about buying a new car, you might want to think about buying a car that is near the beginning of its life cycle versus one that is near the end of its life cycle. And the reasoning here is for a car that's at the beginning of its life cycle, the discounts are usually pretty limited at the beginning of a car's product cycle. So if it were just redesigned for 2019 or 2020, then it probably didn't have a lot of discounts in 2019 or 2020 anyway. But something that was last redesigned in 2015 or 2016 was likely approaching near the end of its product cycle. And traditionally, without all of the supply chain issues that are out there, these cars near the end of their life cycle would have had more discounts applied to them. So if everybody is paying MSRP or more than MSRP anyway, you might as well try to buy the newer design and a car with newer technology and newer engineering in it. And so it might be a little harder to find these cars at MSRP because dealers are going to be the most excited about marking these up. And so a really good example is the new Ford Bronco. There are dealers with $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 markups. But there are dealers out there that are willing to sell it to you at MSRP, and they may be hard to find, but they're worth searching for. And so even if it means traveling a little further away. And I think this is best illustrated at the margin where, let's say right now you're interested in a Honda Civic, and there's a brand new Honda Civic for 2022, but there are still some 2021s out there lingering in the world. And so to the extent that you can find a 2022 Honda Civic at MSRP versus a 2021 at MSRP, I would buy the 2022 because it's a brand new design, clean sheet redesign, and so you'll have all the latest in technology and features. And so if you're planning to buy a used car, this is also really tough because as the shortage of new cars has caused that market to spike and people to have to wait for new cars, used car prices have spiked as well because consumers who couldn't wait to buy a new car are pouring into the used car market. And what's happening is new car dealers still need to do business, and so they need to sell something. And so if there's no new cars for them to sell, they're trying to get their hands on used cars to sell to people. And what's happening is you're seeing dealers starting to think about selling used cars that 2 years ago they would have never kept on their lot because they felt it was a car that maybe didn't meet their standards. But now everybody is so desperate for inventory, dealers are loosening their standards for cars that will go on their lot. So if you're thinking about buying a used car, it becomes even more critical to do the correct due diligence when you're buying a used car. And by this, I mean it is now mission critical to get a pre-purchase inspection by an independent mechanic before you commit to buying a car. So this applies even to certified pre-owned cars, to really new used cars, because what's happening is dealers are really desperate for inventory. And so they're willing to kind of take on cars that maybe at the margin a year or two ago they wouldn't have taken on. And so this is happening even at extremely reputable dealers like major new franchise car dealers, CarMax, Carvana, and some of these big chains that are out there. And so even if you can't get a pre-purchase inspection, so I think CarMax and Carvana don't allow pre-purchase inspections technically. With CarMax, you can do a 24-hour test drive. And so what I would do is if you're interested in a car from CarMax, do the 24-hour test drive and then immediately drive it to a mechanic to get a pre-purchase inspection. Carvana, you don't get to look at the car before you take delivery because they deliver the car all the way to your house. But I think they have a 30-day refund period. And so I would do an immediate post-purchase inspection once you've taken delivery of the car. And then if the inspection comes back absolutely terrible, I would exercise the refund policy at Carvana. I can't remember if it's exactly 30 days or if it's 7 days, but it doesn't matter. I would do that post-purchase inspection the minute it comes off the truck. So the minute they deliver it, I would immediately go and have it inspected by a mechanic that I trust. And for a used car, it's also even more important to cast a wider net if you're looking for something specific. And this applies even if you're looking for something that's not particularly rare or difficult to find or a specific combination, because inventory is now very scattered across the country, and it might be really hard to find what you're looking for compared to 2 years ago. So what should I do if I'm thinking about selling your old car, or if you have an old car or an extra old car lying around? Now is the best time to sell it. So the flip side of the coin of used car prices being at an all-time high is if you have a used car to trade in or sell, then it's a great time. And so in some cases, if your used car is very new within the past 2 or 3 years, you might be very pleasantly surprised at what a dealer is willing to pay you for this car. And so if you're thinking of selling your old car and buying a new one, consider trading it in because it is definitely a deal sweetener for the dealer and might help them kind of might help convince them to work with you on kind of the upcharge over MSRP. And so in many states, there are also sales tax benefits to doing both deals in the same transaction. So you want to make sure you're getting the best price net of that sales tax benefit. And it definitely complicates the deal because the dealership will want to look at the car, but you should shop your car around to multiple dealerships to get a feel for what the car is worth before trading it in or selling it yourself, because you might be surprised at what it's worth, and what you don't want to do is leave some money on the table. So if you have, for example, an older Honda Accord that you'd like to sell, and you're buying a new Toyota Camry, I would see what the Toyota dealer will pay you for the Accord. I would also take it to CarMax and see what they'll pay you for the Accord. I would put it into Carvana and see what they'll pay you. So shop your car around, because most dealers are so interested in getting new used car inventory that pretty much anything built in the past 5 to 7 years is considered extremely desirable by dealers. And so I would shop it around and make sure that you are getting the highest purchase price possible for your old car. And if you can combine that with a dealer that's willing to let you buy your new car at MSRP, you may not be that far worse off than things were 24 months ago, for example. So just something to think about if you have an old car to trade in, especially if it's a newer old car. And so also on that note, if your lease is expiring, I would strongly consider buying out your lease and either driving that car for a couple years or buying the lease, putting it in your name, and then selling it. And so what's happened is because leases written several years ago were written with kind of a different assumed value, a lot of people now suddenly have positive equity in their leases. So in other words, their cars are worth far above what they owe on the car, and that usually never happens. So usually in a lease, you actually want to be underwater because you fulfill the terms of your loan by giving them the car back. But right now what's happening is a lot of people have a lot of positive equity in their lease, and sometimes this can be $1,000, $3,000, $5,000. Sometimes, depending on the car, if it was a very expensive car new, you may have $7,000, $9,000, $10,000 of equity in your car. And so if you need a car and you like your leased car, buying it out at the price in your lease contract, for the most part, is likely going to be lower than buying the same used car on the used car market. And so if you like the car, your lease is ending, and you're reasonably happy with it, I would just buy the lease and then drive it for a couple years, and then revisit the decision in a few years. If you don't want to keep your leased car, I would still consider going through the tedious paperwork of paying off your lease, getting the title, and putting it in your name, and then selling it. Because in the past, you could usually sell it directly to CarMax, and what they would do is they would pay the leasing company, and then they would cut you a check for the difference. A lot of leasing companies have become wise to this and are not allowing that anymore because they want to capture the profit from themselves. So they're only giving you two options. Turn it in to a defined location in your lease agreement, or buy the car out. And so many leasing companies are not allowing a third-party buyout, for example. So if you have a Toyota Corolla lease, you may not be able to trade that lease in to a Honda dealer to buy a Honda Accord. You may only be able to trade it in to a Toyota dealer towards a new Toyota Camry or whatever new Toyota, because automakers are trying to make sure their dealers have access to used cars. So to the extent that they can get their finance arm that financed all these leases to keep as many of these leases inside of their ecosystem as possible, the better off the leasing company is and the better off the dealers are, because now they have access to all these used cars. So that has changed a little bit with this too. I'd never thought I would see a day where so many people had so much positive equity in their leases, but if you happen to be in that situation, you should definitely make the most of it. And now it's time for Rental Car Roulette. So before we get into the latest rental car roulette, I do want to acknowledge one big piece of news in the rental car world, and as it applies to my favorite rental car company, Hertz, and that is Hertz recently announced that they were ordering 100,000 Teslas to add to their fleet. And so this is going to represent about 20% of their fleet. And I, for one, am incredibly excited at the idea of this because Tesla Model 3s, I've heard great things about them, but I haven't had a chance to drive one yet because you don't really see electric cars in the mainstream rental car fleets at Avis, Hertz, or Enterprise. And so Hertz moving 20% of their fleet to Teslas is going to be super interesting, and I'm very excited to see where it goes. I have not yet addressed Tesla on this podcast. I've gotten that request several times in the early lives or in the early weeks of this podcast, and so at some point I do plan to address Tesla, and in that discussion I also want to address kind of the economics of the Hertz Tesla deal specifically, because I think it's incredibly fascinating and represents really interesting thinking from both Hertz and Tesla to agree upon this deal, especially given that Tesla did not grant Hertz any discounts, as far as we know so far, on this massive order of Model 3s. I also am interested in seeing how Hertz will change the customer experience, or how the Tesla Model 3 can help Hertz improve the customer experience in many ways, because to put it bluntly, the Hertz customer experience is absolutely terrible. And I think I still rent from them just because it's so terrible, it's comical. But I think it'll be very interesting to see how the Tesla Model 3 and its introduction into Hertz represents this broader shift in how Hertz thinks about its customer experience and how they interact with their consumers. Plus, with so many of these Model 3s joining Hertz's fleet, there's no way that Hertz will be able to restrict the rental of these to either a super expensive category or only for select customers. So they're going to have to be very broad in how they use these Model 3s. And as somebody who never really books above the minimum rate to use the pick your own car out of the aisle rate, I'm very excited that at some point there will be at least some Model 3s that wind up in the choose any car from the aisle selection, because I don't feel like it's a great value to pay for any of the premium car classes at Hertz. So because there are so many coming, it'll be nice to get to drive one at a pretty discounted rate, hopefully in the future. And now to the main point of the segment. So I recently found myself in a situation where I was renting a car, and I did what I usually do, and I booked a normal midsize car at Hertz and hoped that they would have something interesting in the aisle when I showed up, the section where you can choose whatever car you'd like. And so I showed up to Hertz, and it's still pretty sad, the selection. I mean, Hertz has been able to go out and buy some new cars after the bankruptcy, but it's really variable because, one, there's this whole new car shortage thing, so the rental car companies are having a tough time buying new cars. And two, Hertz still has a lot of the cars from pre-pandemic, and so some of these cars are pushing 2 years old now, and 2 years in rental car years is kind of like 10 years for a normal car. Like, these cars get pretty beat up by people. Just not through any malice or anything, just from being used 50% of the time, right? Versus a normal car is parked for the majority of its life. But anyway, I showed up, and in the aisle there were some interesting stuff. So there was, I think, a couple Buick Encores, a lot of Chevy Trailblazers, which is the subcompact SUV. The general theme is it was largely subcompact SUVs, and I think Hertz is doing this because these cars keep their value really well, so they'll be able to sell them onwards when they're done for relatively lower losses in their, and lose relatively less money on selling the old cars versus other car categories. And so walking the aisles, I mean, a lot of these cars were pretty typical, so a couple Nissan Altimas, a couple Hyundai Santa Fes, but one car caught my attention, and it was a car that I've had people ask me about recently, and that I myself am very curious about as I think about maybe buying a new car next fall, and that was the Mazda CX-30. And so I took this Mazda CX-30. It honestly had been through quite a bit. It had kind of 18,000 miles on the odometer, so it sounds like it's been with Hertz since the beginning of the summer-ish, based on the registration. It looked like it was bought in February or March of 2021. And so it wasn't completely brand new, but it was in reasonably good shape. I think Hertz is trying to do a better job of cleaning their cars now, as a function of the pandemic. And this car was very nice. I really enjoyed driving this car. It's a $26,000-$27,000 car on the open market, and it felt very premium. And so Mazda has done a very nice job in moving the brand up market and being able to offer a really premium feel for not a lot of money. And the CX-30 is an extension of that. And so this one was a select model, so it was one trim above the base car. So it had a few nice things. It had bigger wheels, it had a nicer infotainment system, but it didn't have a ton of features. But Mazda designed the car in such a way where it can still feel very premium inside, even though it didn't have a lot of the features. Like the doors closed with a very solid thunk. The materials that you touched and felt were all really high quality and felt like that they wouldn't be out of place in a less expensive BMW or Mercedes-Benz. And the car was this really nice black color that I think made it look a little more upscale as well. And so I think that helped. And so overall, this was a really nice car. I didn't drive it very far, but I got to drive it about 40 or 50 miles before I returned the car. But I left with a very positive impression. I think the things that bothered me about the CX-30 were it's really difficult to see out the back. And so I was really grateful that the car has standard blind spot monitors. And so I would say if you're getting a CX-30, be glad that those blind spot monitors are there, because otherwise you have this really big blind spot out the back on both sides, just as a function of the design of the hatchback and the rear three quarters of the car. The second thing I didn't like is maybe I've just gotten used to driving cars with power seats, but I was kind of hoping for a power driver's seat at this price point, and Mazda makes you buy one trim package up to get a power driver's seat, and it's bundled with things like a sunroof and I think a fancy audio system and heated seats. And I don't really use heated seats and I don't really care about having a sunroof. And so it would be nice to be able to get a power driver seat and just have the rest of the select trim CX-30. I think the biggest gripe that I had was the infotainment system and the screen. It looks like it's a touchscreen, but it's not a touchscreen. You use this like rotary dial to do it. And so when you have Apple CarPlay or Android Auto up on the screen, those two softwares are primarily designed for touchscreens, and so if you're working without a touchscreen, it's a little clunky sometimes. And I did drive around a little bit distracted trying to navigate between the different menus and making sure that my maps showed up so I knew where I was going, and to be able to skip songs to Spotify, and so trying to figure out how to toggle between the two screens that it showed up. I think distracted me a little bit while I was driving. And so I think that's something that would get better if I owned the car and had it for more than the 36-ish hours I had the car. But something to keep in mind that I think the infotainment is a weak spot in the CX-30. But I really liked all the big things, all the difficult things that Mazda had to do. I think it rode well. It handled well. It felt really luxurious inside. It was the right size for driving in a big city. I was in a big city when I was driving this. And it's a great value for money. So I think, yeah, for around $26,000, $27,000, there's definitely worse cars that you can buy for the money. And if I think about subcompact SUVs right now, I think the CX-30 is probably where I would start my shopping. And so I think until the new Honda HR-V and Toyota Corolla Cross come out, I think the Mazda CX-30 would be my pick in this segment. And so, yeah, it was a great car. I think to the Hertz experience, traditionally bad. When I returned it, I wanted a printed receipt. Hertz does not give printed receipts now, apparently. And usually they email it to you, but they also forgot to email a receipt to me. So I had to go into my Hertz account and download the receipt later to make sure that they didn't forget to check the car in. Because if Hertz forgets to check the car in and it looks like you still have the car, bad things can happen where they think the car's been stolen, you didn't steal the car because you returned it, and somebody else may have rented the car already, so Hertz doesn't have the car, but Hertz can't see that you returned the car and somebody else checked out the car. All they can see is you never returned it, and they can see separately somebody has started a new reservation with the car, but they can't link the fact that two people cannot rent the same car at the same time. And I think that's a big flaw in Hertz's IT system. It's been flawed for a very long time. And so whenever I return a car to Hertz, I always make sure that they scan it in, at least, to try to minimize this. And that's just really annoying. But such is the nature of renting from Hertz, and I'll probably still keep going to Hertz just because it's their operations are so challenging that it's kind of funny. So that's this episode of Rental Car Roulette. So I don't know when I'll be renting a car next. I think it'll be at the end of December. And so I do have a Hertz reservation then as well. So we will see if anything changes at Hertz between now and the end of the year. Thank you for listening to our show. And make sure to subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, it takes a whole village to make a podcast, and so we want to make sure we give due credit to the individuals involved with making this podcast. Our chief technical advisor is Turn It Off and On, and our legal and strategy consultant is Bill Me Moore. Finally, we're assisted by our product planner, Ada Trim, and our finance and insurance manager, Mark Up the Rates.